Friendly greetings. I'm Torley Linden. I do videos, multimedia art, and watermelons in Second Life. And I love showing off the work we do at Linden Lab to benefit our community. You are most absolutely listening to the Draxfouse Radio Hour with Joe Yardley.
Hello and welcome to the first show, the first Draxfouse Radio Hour, a weekly podcast about the metaverse broadcasting from an attic somewhere in Berlin. And I'm here with Joe Yardley, or is it Joe Yardley?
It's Joe. Joe's fine.
Well, thank you, Joe, for for giving me that. I can't remember your name. It's embarrassing. And I will mix it up throughout the show and throughout the life of this show. Anyway, this is the first show. We're very excited. We want a community show focused on the community with lots of voices you can call in, you can write in, you can post stuff on the Flickr page, on the blog. Now, Joe, let me ask you, why are we doing this? Why are we creating more work for ourselves?
I think that because even though there's, of course, a lot of things wrong and a lot of things right with Second Life, you and I really see the potential. You have your video show, documentary, and I run a busy sim, and you know, we're online a lot, and I think that there was place for people like us to talk about things that have to change.
Sometimes the discussion is a little bit black and white. If you're enthusiastic about Second Life, then sometimes you're being accused of sort of being a cheerleader or a Linden Lab, I don't know, not a spy, but sort of a fanboy. A fanboy, that's right.
That's what the young people call it these days.
Right. I forgot to mention that we're old. Go ahead.
Yeah, very, very old. But that's of course, the problem. Everyone knows that there are a lot of things wrong with Second Life, and people get bitter. And often new users, people who are new to Second Life, don't get a very exciting or positive view of Second Life. So if you see the other side, if you are still enthusiastic after a couple of years, and or if you still see the potential, it is quite easy for people to think that you're just that you love everything about Second Life, and we don't.
We're also going to be using a lot of music, so please send us your music and let us know, can we use it? We're happy to purchase it, and of course give proper credit. It could be a music bed, or it could also be a feature. So we're also toying with the idea of live shows, but we have to work the kinks out first, all the technical stuff, until the engine is running smoothly. Also, I look on my screen and I see you sitting there. I mentioned that earlier. What the point for me, which is important, we're talking about virtual reality. We're talking about immersive experiences, and we're actually sitting in that attic. We're recording on Skype, but we're sitting in the attic, we're facing each other, and we have, what do we have there, like a pitcher with some cocktail or something?
Yeah, I've got us two cocktails, and of course a cigarette, and two lovely old-fashioned microphones.
I am not smoking.
I am. But, you know, that's what we're trying to do as well. We want to make a show about Second Life, but we want to record it in Second Life. And if you have a place that you want us to visit, or you have a special event, or anything like that, let us know, and perhaps we'll record one of our next podcasts from your place.
It's a wide open field, and we're experimenting with this format. So let's get started with the top topics. I have here, I mean, it's a new year. Well, happy new year, Yo.
Yes, happy new year to you too.
And everybody is saying that this is the year of virtual reality. I mean, I hear this over and over and over again. And I think people are referring to the convergence of or the advent of workable hardware devices. I mean, is this what they're talking about?
Absolutely. I mean, we can't talk about virtual reality without mentioning the Oculus Rift. It pretty much came out of nowhere. And like me, Pamalaki, who invented the Oculus Rift, tried virtual reality somewhere in the 80s or the 90s and thought, this is fantastic, this is going to go big. And then it died. It pretty much vanished. And thanks to the new Oculus Rift technology, suddenly it's gone big. Anyone who's tried it, and I'm proud to say that I've been one of those people.
Yeah, you tried it actually. How did you try it?
There was a special gathering somewhere at some sort of publicity company. I have no idea. It didn't work very well because I have no idea who they were. But they had an Oculus Rift, and they invited people to come and try it. And so there I was in between all these 12 and 13-year-old boys.
And what did they have for a demo? Did they have the demos that you see, that you saw at that time?
Yes, I tried several demos. But the roller coaster one is the smoothest one. It was the one that's finished.
And I just want to mention that we'll have David Rowe from Control Alt Studio Viewer on in a couple of weeks here in the podcast. That's a third-party viewer that has Oculus Rift implementation. The official viewer doesn't have it yet, although it was announced. Going back to the hardware, Oculus Rift guys were at CES unveiling a new device with positional tracking improved.
Lucky's just put me into Starship Oculus, so this is a bit more sinister, scary setting. And yeah, I mean, there's a flashlight on... It's another first-person perspective, obviously, and the flashlight is on your eyes. So you look around, and that flashlight lights up exactly what's in front of you. There's this hanging rope here that I can just kind of rotate around.
It got me to do things in a game that I normally don't, right? Like, it got me staring at the ceiling and looking down at my feet and
well,
that
really
kind of stuff,
it's
right?
Really interesting, because even with the relatively low res right now, we're going to greatly improve it in the future.
Sure.
But even right now, the limitation of the experience is not the resolution of the device. You run into the limitations of textures
right.
And, you know, and all of the models that you're putting on. You go up to a wall, and it very much looks like, I don't know, some kind of flat acrylic box that's had something spray-painted on it. It doesn't look like you would expect a real wall to have.
Right.
And that's something that you wouldn't notice unless you're actually able to get up close to it and look at it in stereo 3D.
And they were saying that the nauseating issue is a thing of the past. Did you feel that was a big issue for you?
I didn't experience that at all. And I even tried the roller coaster standing up without anyone holding me. And I didn't get nauseous at all. But the main reason that people feel a bit confused or, you know, their balance is a bit off is because your body is not moving along with your activities, because the virtual reality is so realistic that, you know, when you are running in a game and your body is standing still, of course you get a bit dizzy or confused.
I was going to add that, and we'll link to this also, that Palmer Luckey and a bunch of others appeared on a White House We the Geeks, that's right.
Hi, and welcome to the White House's first We the Geeks of 2014. I'm Kristen Dorgolo. I'm very excited for today's discussion.
Fantastic. And Palmer, it's great to see you.
Woo, I'm finally here.
All eyes in the tech industry are focusing on Las Vegas for CES, otherwise known as the Consumer Electronics Show.
What we've been doing for about the last year is we've been selling developer kits. So we're selling virtual reality headsets, developer kits with the hardware and software. And we've shipped about 50,000 of those to people all over the world. Not actually, the U.S. isn't even, you know, the biggest chunk of people. It turns out people all over the world are interested in this.
And what's the kind of reaction that someone has when they interact with an Oculus Rift system for the first time?
Virtual reality is interesting, even in its current form. You know, we're not to the holodeck type of stage, and we won't be for a long time. But we've spent a very long time in our lives learning how to look around at things, how to listen to things, how to, you know, hear something and instantly turn in the right direction. And then if you look at the ways we interact with 3D environments today, generally, we're either using controllers that we're holding or a keyboard and a mouse, or even with Kinect, you know, you're controlling an abstract representation of something on a screen. When you have VR and everything is one-to-one scale, all of that time that people have spent learning how to interact with things in the real world can translate over to interacting with things in the virtual world.
It was good to see that they, while not interested in Second Life as they used to, I did a few things with the State Department way back when.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that if anyone understands the potential of the Oculus Rift and virtual reality, it's probably the government, because they've been using them, very expensive versions of these, for training, for defense, and all sorts of other things. So to them, it's probably not new. And they are realizing that it's going to go big, because what a lot of people are not understanding or don't quite get yet is that virtual reality is going to go global, and it's going to get out of computer games. And a lot of people still think that it will just be something that we can do in Second Life or for computer games, and it's going to be just those 12, 30-year-old boys with too much pocket money who will have an Oculus Rift. You know, there's so many things. Exercise, you know, using an Oculus Rift for exercise is, you know, it might even make me do exercise, and that means a lot.
Well, I mean, you know, people know kind of my, I think, political bent, since I'm kind of open about it, as long as we have an environment that really fosters sort of free creative expression, I'm fine with it. I think it's problematic, and we'll talk about this also in future podcasts, that everything is sort of used for military purposes or for just training people for combat, that type of thing. I look at it very critically. I look very critically at the militarization of society. So, but that's something that we will explore in this podcast as well. I just want to add that yesterday I taped a interview with Babbage, formerly Babbage Linden, that a lot of people I know are looking forward to. He doesn't think that it will just come on like, you know, that this is sort of this big splash where it totally goes mainstream. He maintained that it will. I think he said in the interview that it will never go mainstream.
Yeah, I completely disagree. By the end of this year, the Oculus Rift commercial version is going to be in the supermarkets, to say. People will want to buy it. And once you've tried it, you'll want one.
Right. And I guess if they bundle it even with a console, perhaps something like
yes,
that.
Yes, exactly. And once, you know, someone realizes all the other options that you have, you know, if we get the first television broadcast, that is 360 degrees. I mean, that is something people want to try. I've tried the 3D glasses. I was not impressed at all. And we know that hundreds and thousands of people have bought these super expensive 3D TVs with those stupid glasses to get a little bit of eeny-weeny, teeny-weeny 3D effect.
I very much agree with you that the killer here is that the full immersion. I mean, Google Glass or 3D glasses or anything where you still have sort of the peripheral view of the actual physical world, to me, makes no sense.
Yeah, it's a completely different thing. I mean, I don't want one, but I'm sure the Google Glass has lots of interesting, nice gadgets and possibilities. But for us, you know, for people in Second Life, but also for people who play computer games, immersion is the most important thing. And it also for people who want to watch a movie or want to watch television, immersion is it. That's the big thing.
I am also old school in the sense that I enjoy doing one thing at a time. I think that's a very, very healthy thing in this multitasking world, to really kind of focus on one thing. And that's why I love the immersion. If I choose to immerse myself, let's say, into 1920s Berlin via an hardware device, I want to really be in there. I don't want to know that somebody else is calling me from 2013 right now, because I want to really be in there.
Exactly. It is a matter of time before someone's going to get a heart attack watching a movie on Oculus Rift.
And you did a test area in 1920s Berlin, right?
Yes, because I've spoken to a few people who tried the Oculus Rift in Second Life. And all of a sudden, when your camera is in mouse look all the time, suddenly you realize how weird the scale is in Second Life, because most people just sort of guess, you know, they make a big avatar and then they make a big building and they want, and because the camera is usually above your shoulder, the ceilings are very high. So people who tried Oculus Rift for the first time have found themselves like a little tiny dwarf in a forest of giants. And I've always built 1920s Berlin to a more realistic scale. You know, a 50 centimeter prim is 50 centimeter. So when people made it into Second Life, into 1920s Berlin, they realized that is suddenly scale is very, very important. And so I decided to build this little test area, not only for people with Oculus Rift, but also for people who aren't quite sure about realistic scale, want to experiment with that.
What's funny is that so many companies are springing up, a virtual dance club or something, stuff that is just inside our beloved virtual world called Second Life has been there for years. And now people come on like, hey, this is really cutting edge. Now we can have a virtual dance club.
It is a bit sad and painful that, you know, people are starting Kickstarters and collecting tens of thousands of dollars because everyone's excited and interested. And they are doing things that we've been doing for years. For instance, the virtual cinema, watch a movie together in a cinema that's virtual. I mean, of course, in Second Life, watching a movie is not very easy, and I'm sure they can make easier and better software, but the idea already exists. I mean, I spent every Sunday in 1920s Berlin watching a movie.
I totally skipped over the first segment that I wanted to talk about. People are disappointed because that there is still tech issues. People are logged out. There is general tech problems. I just want to preface this with my personal experience. I see a lot of improvement, and they did deliver. They delivered that Project Sunshine.
Yeah, I think there is no doubt that Second Life for the last, well, let's say a year, I'm not quite sure, let's say in 12, 13, that they've done a lot of work and there have been a lot of improvements. I think there's no doubt about it, but you know, they still have a lot of work to do.
Yeah, I guess the question is really, is it enough? Is it going fast enough?
For me, it's going fast enough because, you know, it's all right. I see the improvements and I know what Second Life offers. But for new users, you know, we're spoiled. If you look at games from 2-3 years ago, if they offer a smooth, lag-free world that you can explore and do things about, you know, and they come to Second Life and they don't have that experience, they're going to give up.
Do you want to mention the terms of service? We're going to link to a couple of, I think, really well-written blog posts by Mona Eberhard and Tatero Nino.
I sort of understood the toss and realized that Linden Lab would not start selling our virtual little arty-farty things that we build.
What? Do you mean they don't want to make money out of your awesome microphone there, steal it and then sell it and make dough and go to the Bahamas?
They already make money out of all that things. No, I mean that my problem is that I use a lot of third-party websites for my resources. For instance, this room here, the ceiling, the brick, all those things, those textures. I don't have time to make every single individual texture, so I use third-party websites who give me those textures, and they have certain agreements, and they say, you know, you can't sell them separately on Second Life, which is fine, but you can use them for what you're building. And these are now saying, we no longer allow that, and that is a problem, because, you know, and they say they've talked to Linden Lab and they were not convinced. And I think it's very important that Linden Lab sort of convinces these people or makes some sort of agreement on paper that at least the biggest texture websites are okay with us using them again. Because now you have to look harder or make your own pictures, which is fine, but it takes more time and it sort of makes creativity a bit more difficult. And creativity is the cornerstone of Second Life.
I'm going to link to a documentary that came out last year called Terms and Conditions May Apply, and it's about how big Silicon Valley social media companies snuck in terms of services that are very, very, well, don't leave a lot of freedom to the actual user. And I mean, a lot of that stuff is known, how big companies like Facebook monetize what their business model is. They collect personal data and they sell those to advertisers and so on and so forth. But I think it's important that we are at least a lot more conscious about this stuff and then form an opinion, because the point that is made in the movie that that nobody really cares. And that also plays in what we're going to talk about in a second, is the NSA and the whole spying, right? The whole surveillance state. So everybody needs to see this and then really think about, where do I stand? What was shocking to me is that most people really don't care at all.
Well, maybe I'm cynical or something like that.
I can guarantee that you are. Go ahead.
I'm cynical and bitter, but the thing that surprised me most about the NSA story is that people were shocked, and I would have been shocked if the NSA was not in Second Life. I mean, maybe I'm paranoid as well, but I'm quite sure that secret services all over the world are trying to get as much information as they can. And if you've got a virtual world where people can communicate freely, of course someone's going to try and listen in. And it seems that, you know, it seems that the NSA is taking Second Life more seriously than the media.
I don't know if that's good or very, very sad.
A bit of both.
At least somebody takes us serious, Zoe. That's good.
Exactly.
You know, a lot of back and forth on the various blogs about when it came out that Corey Andreka had a brown bag lunch at the NSA. I mean, people went as far as to say, you know, he and Philip Rosedale created Second Life solely to create sort of a realm where people feel secure, and then you can totally surveil them.
Well, I know I'm paranoid, but I think that you know, it's 2014. If there are still people in the world who use the internet for whatever, Second Life, the internet, Skype, and think that people can't listen to them, that they are absolutely safe and secure, I think that's a bit naive.
Since we have started on the NSA, we're gonna listen to an interview that I did with Ashkin, who is a furry in Second Life, also a viewer developer with Exodus Viewer, and in real life, he's a test engineer, right? So I have no idea what that is, but I asked him what it is, and. Here's his reply.
I'm always thrown off guard by somebody asking that question. It's basically somebody who goes about testing software, but also orchestrates a test plan and how to test software. In my case, I also do physical security as well. So it's not only in the case of just testing the quality of software, but the technical security of software and even the physical security, you know, are server secure, all that kind of stuff as well.
And if I may reveal this to our listening audience, you are a furry in SL?
Yes, I am. And I'm also a furry in real life. If that makes a big difference, I don't know.
Okay, so I want to talk to you about the NSA spying and what does it have to do with furries. Somebody posted a little excerpt of a research paper that they did. They researched furries. The NSA went in there and among other things, they researched furries and they came to the conclusion that furries often work in creative fields, either arts or programming.
Well, I guess in the case of why NSA research furries, it's one of those things that know your enemy or know who your enemies are. In this case, obviously, you know, they were trying to do their due diligence. Are these people a risk? Well, we don't know. Let's go ahead and find out. Well, these people commonly work in this type of field. These people, you know, for example, you're not going to see artists making bombs.
So the intel tells them that that furries, if they indeed are overwhelmingly active in programming, they are a potential threat.
Yeah. For example, things that intelligence organizations will look at specifically is stuff like hackathons, where you get all these hackers coming together trying to create something new or unusual or showing people how to break through systems. They keep a close eye on that kind of stuff because that stuff can be quite easily used for the wrong things. And I imagine that when they were looking at furries, they were basically just trying to figure out, well, we see that there's this big new community of people coming along. They, you know, some of them can be quite vocal about, you know, their beliefs. And I believe that's just in general, you get that from kind of every fandom. I mean, I can think of stuff like the Bieber fans? The Bieber fans are very vocal about how much they love Bieber and die for him and all that kind of stuff. And I imagine that sometimes some of that stuff probably triggers what the NSA would have as a watch list of words. Ah. So it wouldn't surprise me if quite a few furries just happened to say something that triggered a lot of alarms.
Is it true in your estimation that furries, when they are in the programming field, are they more libertarian, anti-government?
A lot of furries probably are onto large organizations. At least from my personal experience with communicating with a lot of furs, the actual thought behind anything is that, oh, this is too big, I don't like this thing anymore. And I don't think that's so much the consensus of a furry community, but I would say a good majority of people tend to be like that. They don't like big organizations. I mean, even in the furry world, we've got big art sites like Fur Affinity, and you even have lots of furries going, oh, I don't like Fur Affinity. It's a big, powerful entity, and it's just a website where you post your art to. It wouldn't surprise me if that kind of mentality made the NSA uneasy, and I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of the furries that are developers would probably think this way as well.
Did you personally ever suspect that the NSA is in Second Life? I mean, I hear a lot of people say, of course I knew that they were going in.
I actually heard years ago that the FBI were in Second Life because they were looking at pedophiles and such. And one thing that I thought that was kind of useful to note is perhaps the NSA were in Second Life under the FBI's name, because as you recall, the tapping that the NSA did was actually done through a lot of FBI warrants. And so I wonder if the NSA in particular came into Second Life through some of the FBI investigations on Second Life as well. As to whether I was aware, I say I wasn't really aware of it, but I would say that I kind of assumed that some sort of federal investigation was often taking place in Second Life anyway.
I find it always troublesome when big internet companies willfully just give away all the data when the government asks them.
At the end of the day, these companies are required to work within legal frameworks and such. And the problem is when you have a big government agency coming to you and saying, hey, I'd like to get this information about a possible criminal activity, or, you know, they may actually even threaten you by saying, please hand over this information. We don't want to get a warrant and all this other complicated matters involved. And I imagine that often lawyers would advise companies work with the government.
But isn't then the entire anonymity that we have in avatar-based environments, that the whole sort of agency we have over our own identity, I mean, isn't that all just baloney and a pipe dream? I mean, when I interviewed Rod Humble, I remember it was so refreshing to hear him say that he was actually really fond of that versus the forced exhibitionism of the Facebook model.
I think it's best to assume that if you're doing anything on a private service, then you assume that these people are going to work with government entities. You have to deal with that. If you want to work on, you know, promoting things anonymously or have anonymous communications, then you need to look at other platforms that are actually designed for that. LinLab definitely logs all messages that go through. We know this. They've already stated this numerous times.
I mean, you still have the power over your own anonymity when it comes to interacting with other people in the world. I mean, they don't have access to that data, so that means I can still roam freely within Second Life.
I would debate that a tiny bit. Everything you do on the internet generally leaves a crumb trail. Basically, I could trick people into visiting a website, and based off those visits on the website, I know who I gave this link to, I know what time I gave it to them, and by getting these people to visit the website, I can then look at the logs on the server and see, okay, these are the IP addresses for these individual users. And then I could say, okay, these two IP addresses match. They must be coming from the same location, the same house. This is probably the same person. There's lots of ways to trick people into doing stuff like this. And so I don't truly believe that there is this complete anonymity unless you're actually really super paranoid. And by super paranoid, I mean you don't visit websites. You don't actually go exploring around on Second Life. You don't really communicate with people, but then that's not a very social environment.
Then it's back to basing it on sort of intuition and sort of a gut feeling. How much do you reveal to that person in Second Life, right?
And then there's also the fact that, for example, I had experience with griefers for the past few years just harassing me. And over time, you actually kind of learn how people write. You kind of learn their style of things. So you're actually able to match different people. So, you know, you could have 10 different avatars and you're interacting with people on a daily basis. You'd be able to actually recognize the style of a certain individual, even how long sentences they write. So on Second Life, I'm quite known with my friends to just kind of run around them and jump around a lot. And I'm actually quite good at jumping on things or jumping on people.
I've seen that, yeah.
It gets to the point that sometimes I've logged on a bot out or something because I have like a ton of bot outs for like different projects I've tried in the past. And I'll be visiting a sim for whatever reason, usually testing some sort of viewer bug. And if I see a friend, I'll start running around them and jumping around them, and they'll instantly start talking to me because they know it's me, and I haven't even told them that this is my alt or anything, but they can just tell just from the fact that I'm jumping around and everything.
Yeah, that's fascinating. A lot of people are very cynical right now when the news came that Corey Andreka went to the NSA at a brown bag lunch and basically did a presentation about Second Life, and there's a lot of people saying he intentionally created the world to hand them sort of a gift where the agencies could spy on people. I mean,
I don't think anybody originally thought about doing that initially. And at the end of the day, the whole purpose behind Second Life is that people are trying to make money off it. If I was to guess, they've always tried to promote it as a platform for telecommuting. I also find it a bit strange that this also comes from the company that really doesn't like people telecommuting.
That's a whole other subject matter.
Basically, when I've tried to apply for a job in the past to Linden Lab, I've been told that I would have to either relocate or every day travel to the Linden Lab offices in some specific location. And so that kind of destroyed it for me.
I think there's a
resurgence of old school managers who want to see people in front of them. It doesn't matter if they're mentally checked out as long as they see some bodies.
One of the big features that they were trying to present to companies like IBM was the fact that you could have meetings all around the world in Second Life without, you know, needing to use expensive video conferencing systems and all that other jazz.
That's right. Let's wrap up. So NSA has been spying. Where do we go from here? Should we be completely paranoid, or should we just have sort of due diligence like you suggested earlier?
Well, my take on it is if you're distributing sensitive information, then you should be using a secure platform for that.
A handwritten letter that is delivered by hand.
You know, there's other alternatives. I mean, there's stuff like the Freenet project, which is basically a system that allows you to send messages privately, anonymously to other people, or, you know, highly secured as well, so that people can't simply read your communications if you don't want them to. There's not many communications where I actually worry, like, what I have to send over Second Life. I mean, the only time I kind of worry is if I'm bringing up something real life related to do with business confidentiality. And I really shouldn't be talking about those things on Second Life anyway. So for me, the answer is quite simple. Just keep that stuff on the business network and keep my personal stuff, well, with myself.
All right. So that was Ash Westar Ashkin, viewer developer in Second Life with the Exodus viewer team. And in real life, a test engineer. Now we know what a test engineer is. And we're going to link to what he mentioned, the Freenet project, way to be anonymous on the web. As we're taping this, my friend Peter Ludlow, a journalist and a professor, also known as Yuri Zina Sklar from the Alphaville Herald, posted this on Facebook from Wired.com that an Osama bin Laden avatar could potentially recruit terrorists and extend the bin Laden influence way past his own physical demise.
Yeah, of course. I mean, Second Life is a fantastic tool for propaganda and politics. We have communist parties in Second Life. We have neo-Nazi parties and even entire Sims, even though they usually don't last very long.
Philip Rosedale used to say that a world like Second Life is very sort of self-regulative in the sense that when somebody puts up a swastika, you know, the neighborhood will clean itself up by telling this guy to get out.
Yeah, unless you, of course, have a private homestead.
Exactly.
I followed someone who started harassing people in our Berlin Sim. And I had a little look in his private, in his tags and his favorites. And when I went to have a look at his sim, I found a lovely little Nazi Disney park sort of fun place. And of course, I reported it, but there were swastikas all over the place.
I'm looking at this article. It is actually a study entitled 3D Cyberspace Spillover, Where Virtual Worlds Get Real.
In the end, it is just another tool for media tool, just like cinema or the radio or television. It can be used for propaganda. And with virtual reality, it has a little extra bonus because you can, besides meeting an avatar of your favorite evil guy, you can also train shooting guns and making bombs and having all sorts of crazy fun.
It has even advantages over sort of a forum, right? You can actually make that bomb explode.
Yeah, exactly.
You buy the right script.
You can test.
I think it's the magnifying effect. It could magnify whatever crazy belief you have or movement that you're trying to get off the ground is actually larger than you believe it is.
Absolutely. It is very easy to find like-minded people and think that you're not alone.
That is the dark side of intentional communities anyway. Ugh. Mm-hmm. No, I'm depressed.
we use that. I use that to meet other crazy people like me who are obsessed with the past.
Well, I'm looking forward to people commenting on the blog about this because I think we really have to think about how much information do we hand over when we're online, and we need to be conscious of where that data goes, who has that data, and how that data travels. We're going to link, of course, to Stephen Colbert making fun of Second Life. I think that's well done, although he does revive the First Life, Second Life joke, but he does it in a funny way. A couple other things that we totally skipped over, the Lily Allen controversy.
I suppose I should tell you what this bitch is thinking.
What is going on with Lily Allen? Who is Lily Allen?
I had to Google her, but apparently she's world famous, at least in the UK. She's a singer, a pop singer, probably quite a charming lady. And she's famous and all that sort of thing. And she tweeted that she had regrets because 5 years ago, she was offered a couple of Bitcoins to perform in Second Life. And she said, as if. And of course, now Bitcoins are worth quite a lot. And she calculated that she was offered hundreds of thousands of Bitcoins. And those would now be worth millions. Two kinds of stories. Some people say that in early 2000, when was it? When it started? I'm not quite sure. Yeah, she said 5 years ago, at the beginning of 2009, there were not hundreds and thousands of Bitcoins around.
2009.
But I think by the end of 2009, there were. So, you know, when she says about 5 years ago.
That's right.
She's a pop artist. She could mean 4 years ago.
Or last year.
Yeah. What does she know?
The point is, what is really funny is that it did bring Second Life back into the social media news cycle.
Absolutely. This is PR that Linden Lab can't afford with their entire annual budget. I mean, she's got 3 million followers on Twitter. There are millions and millions of people have heard the name Second Life, and in combination with a famous star and with Bitcoins. So, you know, this is it can't be bad.
Now, people may know that we both, although eloquent and outspoken, don't know everything, right? And one of the things that I really did not understand was fitted mesh that came along last year. I mean, do you know what fitted mesh is?
Yeah, sort of.
You do? Okay, then I can kill the next segment.
I sort of understand it. When you buy mesh clothes, they come in a couple of sizes, but the shape does not change. I mean, it either fits or it doesn't. And I can't wear mesh clothes at all. Because every single dress or coat or whatever I buy, my hips stick out. So what fitted mesh is going to do, or liquid mesh or whatever they call it, is that the mesh clothes will fit any shape. They will adapt to the shape of your avatar. They will use the skeleton of your avatar to make sure that the coat fits properly.
I contacted three wonderful creators in Second Life and interviewed them, and they gave me so much information I had to edit it down a little bit. Let's listen to these interviews. The first one is with Tier Rosenblum. She's a designer, co-owner of Auxiliary and Creative Resources. She told me where fitted mesh came from in the first place.
It was actually a bug that shouldn't have been in Second Life initially, at least from what I understand. It uses what is called the C-bone. And before these big changes, what it would do is it would only resize limited bits of the mesh, and it wasn't supported either. They would keep threatening us that C-bones wouldn't be supported, don't use them. You know, we might change the avatar, don't use them. Red Poly Inventor came out with this magical way to do it that surprised the entire grid, which kind of put a spotlight on C-bones starting in, I think, 2012 with this massive meeting that happened for mesh. Shortly after that, you saw a few other people figure out how to do it, because before you had to manually make the bones yourself. And that's something that I wasn't able to do. I couldn't figure out for Maya, which is what I use. But people have figured it out for Blender, like Gaia with Avastar. And people had figured it out for 3D Max, and you started to see more and more creators figure out how to get this in world.
Let's go even more basic. Now, what is a C-bone?
Oh, geez. C-bone is like the sliders. So, like, if you have a chest slider and you want to make your avatar, if you're a lady, bigger, the C-bone would affect around your breast area. It was crazy. It looks so good. I tested it, and just, I could take my mesh to extreme sizes and it wouldn't break the mesh. It wouldn't, I mean, for the most part, the avatar with slider scales up to 100 fit the mesh near perfect.
Mesh will fit, hopefully. Is this something that is only working in the beta view? Is a special viewer, or is it implemented?
Yeah, you have to use the project viewer.
And so what are you working on specifically now that really What would you highlight that really makes a difference with the fitted mesh?
Well, see, I'm actually right now trying to find the problems with it, because it works beautifully with pants. It works beautifully with long-sleeved and any kind of sleeve top. So for me, I mean, really the spectrum right now for most clothes, it'll look beautiful. But I am trying to find the issues with it, because I kind of want to find where its weakest points are, because I don't want to sell it as this perfect Band-Aid fix for mesh at all, because it's not. There are still major issues with it. For instance, I was working on a dress, and it was like a mini dress that goes where it dips under the arm. And I realized that if you don't have, there's a bone on the armpit of the avatar, basically, that adjusts when you adjust your fat to the sides. So if there is no influence on that bone, like nothing is affecting that bone, if you resize, your avatar breaks through the mesh. But if you are using a mini dress and have that bone affect it, and your arms go down, the entire side of the dress goes into the avatar.
So it's very much trial by error. I mean, you stumbled upon this by accident, if you will, I mean, with the bone.
Oh, yeah. I was really excited about it, too. I was like, this is going to be really cute. And then I uploaded it, and it was not cute at all. It was not good. It was a lot of work, and it was not good.
But you're a very diligent person. You stick with it.
I knew nothing about 3D before 2011. I told myself I was never going to learn it. And then when Mesh came out, I was like, you know what? I'm going to do this. And I figured out how to model. And then after that, I figured out how to rig. And I really just like to take the bull by the horn.
So this was Tyr Rosenblum. And the next person that I interviewed on the subject was Ebony Khan. She owns Ebony's House of Hoochie brand since 2005, so she's a real old bee. And there was also some confusion with the terminology, fitted mesh, then liquid mesh, and she helped me figure this out.
Liquid mesh is, first of all, a term that I don't like. It should be like, you know, almost like if this was real life, it'd probably be like a little trademark term, because it's used by a specific brand. The liquid mesh items are the items that you can currently get in SL, which are based off of the current avatar. It's not supported. So if you buy those items, it's a hack. I don't see it changing or breaking, because it hasn't at this point. And even still with the new viewer, because I tested my existing items in the new viewer, they still work. The most difficult thing about creating content in SL and supporting things in SL is the wide variety of machines. And then you put on top of that people are using all different kinds of viewers, all different versions. It makes it very difficult to provide support. Getting back to fitted mesh, though, what fitted mesh is it's new, where there are more bones added. So the sliders that affect your stomach, there's no control for them currently for people to be able to rig clothing to them. So if I want to make it so people can expand their stomach right now, there's no way to do it within the current system, but there will be in the new system.
And then when I adjust the slider, the clothing will move proportionally and expand and contract.
Yes. For the average human avatar, this means that they will be able to wear a good number of clothing without being required to change their shape or have a specific shape. I released some boots that have collision rigging, but the collision rigging is limited. I mean, I found that collision rigging is perfect for making thigh-high boots, because you can, it reacts to all the leg sliders. The torso is where the issues came in with collision rigging, because it doesn't work with the breast, the butt, or the stomach. But for the legs, it's perfect, because everything reacts to collision rigging. So making thigh-high boots, it's perfect for it. And I didn't actively market them as working that way. I didn't want to confuse people, not because I was trying to be secretive, but the problem that I have with content creation and SL and what people have to do with their avatars is it's too much effort to get dressed in SL. Like, it's a virtual world. You should just be able to put something on and have it work.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you mentioned this earlier about the Second Life avatar really being the problem. What is the problem with the Second Life avatar?
The problem with the avatar really is, and I think I might have a different perspective from some people that you may have interviewed, because I have been in SL since 2004, and the avatars were not that important in the beginning. The important thing was the ability to build. You have to remember at this time, you know, 2003, 2002, 2003, you couldn't just get like an architectural program to be able to build easily. And then what happened is Dare.com started to fold. And when those type of casual users came into SL in large numbers, the focus of SL changed a little bit more to casual people. And these people didn't want to come in the world and create a bunch of stuff. They didn't want to, you know, make their own things. Because, I mean, think about it. You get $10 in lendings, you can buy a lot of stuff. If you go to events now, you can get a house, you can get furniture, you can get an outfit. You might be able to get a skin and hair all for $10 at an event. Things shifted, and then avatars became more important. But then now you have all these users, you start to have all this content. I mean, that would have probably been the time to change the avatar. Maybe it would have been 2005, 2006. But the issue was SL had a lot of technical issues, so it was still trying to work out technical issues. And now that SL is stable, people are like, avatar, 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 we need better avatars.
And I understand if they introduce it now, it'll break everything. Probably they've been thinking about this, but how could it be improved?
If there was more density in joints, in the shoulders, or in the elbows, it would make animating and it would make clothing smoother. The avatar is as small as possible, put it that way. It's as least dense as possible, which is good because it makes the avatar very lightweight. And I think it could be redesigned without making it much heavier. You have to balance. And so the lab has to be able to balance giving people what they want by more options on the avatar, but at the same time, keeping SL to a point where the system requirements don't jump to the level of like a high-end game, because there's a lot of people in SL with like 5 and 7 year old computers. If you look at the stats, most people aren't even using widescreen monitors. They're still using like old CRT size monitors. But I like that the lab actually doesn't respond to everything that customers want and just give them everything that they want, because if they did, SL wouldn't work at all.
So that was Ebony Khan from Ebony's House of Hoochie Brand. And I also talked to Kathy Foyle. Now, the interesting thing is that Kathy designed a Maya plugin, a plugin for Maya that has templates for fitted mesh. And she has some interesting comments on the mesh deformer, Carl's mesh deformer, that I think is off the table. But let's listen to Kathy Foyle. She's a designer of shoes and other things. And she designed that Maya plugin.
I saw a niche in the market to make a liquid mesh as easy to use for Maya users as Avastar was used for Blender. And a lot of people were using it to make liquid mesh. And now fitted mesh uses the same principles.
Now, the difference now between what Carl was proposing, what he got into Inworth, I think it's, I don't know if, is it working in there? And you would have preferred that, if I understand correctly.
Yeah, overall, it worked better for what I wanted to do with it, which was basically I wanted to create replacement body parts. And because I kind of got into replacing the feet with my shoes. With the mesh deformer, you could replace individual body parts, and you could also replace the whole avatar itself. Carl's method used the actual vertexes of the avatar mesh itself to move the vertexes of the clothing. If you were to, in Second Life, press Control Shift R, you would go into wireframe mode and you would actually see the wireframe mesh of your avatar. Any place where you see the wires cross or the wires touch, that's called a vertice. The avatar skeleton is actually a deformer itself. It's a type of deformer. And you weight the vertices of the wire mesh to the different bones of the skeleton. And when the skeleton bends, it bends those vertices that are weighted to that particular bone. Yeah, what weight means is a vertice can be weighted to more than one bone. So if it was weighted to, say, the wrist and to the elbow, you might have a vertice that is weighted equally to both, 50-50 weighted to each. So when somebody's adjusting the weights, they're adjusting how much influence will one bone have over a particular vertice. The hands, when you change the size of the hands, the scale of the bone or the joint changes, kind of like a keyframe animation. And they did the same thing with the belly and with the butt and with the musculature of the avatar. And Carl's mesh deformer, it responds to those different shapes because it's using the vertices of the actual avatar mesh to influence the clothing vertices that you're wearing. It follows the shape very, very accurately. The fitted mesh just changes the scale of the vertices. So it doesn't follow the shape, the actual shape of the avatar closely. If you had an avatar head and a face, the vertexes for the lips and the eyes, as long as they were pretty close to the original avatars as far as placement, when the original avatar would blink its eyes and the mesh would move, it would then make the custom mesh head vertices move. And I actually tested this out and it worked perfectly. There are benefits and drawbacks to both Carl's version and fitted mesh. Fitted mesh works really well for clothing that covers the majority of the body and doesn't have a lot of skin showing. Carl's works much better for things that are very tight fitting or that have a lot of skin showing.
It's my understanding that the mesh deformer is completely off the table for at least the Second Life grid.
Yeah, as far as I can tell, their decision is finalized, which is kind of sad. I was actually trying to push for both. Because if they hadn't added fitted mesh, we still would have had the original collision bones. And so if they had picked the mesh deformer, we would have had two different deformers that people could choose from. The fitted mesh can be made a lot better and a lot easier to use. And hopefully they'll get to that point.
So that was Kathy Foyle. She mentioned the Avastar plugin for Blender that was made by Machinimatrix. So now, Yo, even I know what fitted mesh is. Have you learned anything new?
But we're still, I didn't know which one was which.
Well, we know that Carl is out.
Yeah, that's a shame. I mean, I think we're still all waiting for one that actually works and that is easily accessible for everyone.
Yeah, I think it goes back to what we talked about earlier. It should be easy to put the stuff on and then look good right away.
90% of Second Life can remain complicated because as soon as you understand the possibilities and as soon as you find a place in Second Life that you like, you're hooked. But look at The Sims. I mean, creating an avatar is fantastically easy and also fun to do. And changing clothes is like two clicks and it always fits. You know, they don't have that problem.
At this point, I want to remind folks, please send us your feedback on that issue. What needs to be fixed now? What's the most annoying thing? And also, Johan, we talked about this. We'll try to get noobs on the line.
I really long to hear from people who tried it. You know, if you're just in Second Life for just a few weeks, because you know we're old, we don't remember.
Yes, we're old. That's a nice note to end on. The hour went by fast. Thanks so much for listening. Give us your feedback. Write in. Bash us, trash us, but in a polite way, okay? You can write us, radio@draxfiles.com. You can call us on Skype, Draxfiles. You can IM or drop an odd card on Draxfiles, the avatar. Yeah, he's real. We already got a whole bunch of suggestions on the blog, and one was talk about griefers. So, yeah, I took that to heart and I contacted someone by the name of Esteban Winsmore. I don't know if the folks out there know who he is, but he has confirmed to come on the show and talk about what he does and why he does it. If you don't know, I mean, I know that you know, but if a listener doesn't know who Esteban Winsmore is, I encourage them to Google. We will have him on this podcast and I think it'll be a fascinating conversation. I really do believe that he's more akin to a performance artist, almost what he does. I mean,
a bit of a comedian.
Isn't that the highest rated Second Life content on YouTube?
It's quite interesting because, to be honest, of course, people harassing other people is always a bit annoying and childish and sort of thing. But I can't help laughing at it. He's very good at it, and to be honest, he's not bothering anyone really. I mean, because you know, if you don't like him, kick him out.
That's exactly the point.
We'll talk about that when he gets here.
My final words, this weekend I'm going to film at the Lavender Field. A Rock a Smile Marathon is on Saturday, 11 a.m. I'm also going to be attending the Ole Etzel Lecture on Machinima because I don't know how to make Machinima and I need to learn it.
Yeah, I was just going to suggest that.
Very nice, Joe. Well, have a good weekend, everyone. And Joe, I see you right here next Friday. Bye.
Auf Wiedersehen.
And to round out the hour, here's some outtakes from the last Drex Files video, episode 15, about Scotty's Polk Artist and Tiny Otter. Just too much good stuff ended up on the cutting room floor. Here it is with some music from Mamalov Sky Tower underneath. Enjoy.
My name in Second Life is Scottius Polk. I am a tiny otter. I joined Second Life in March of 2008, and it's probably by the summer that I completely converted to an otter. I'm more introverted in person, and the otter himself is, you know, bombastic and kind of out of control. I definitely think that he's one part of me. He's got this creative energy that I like to associate with. You know, there'll be often women who'll say, "Oh, I just want to pick you up and hug you." At some point in my 30s, I just had to take a break, kind of run out of creative steam. Yeah, the issues of putting your art out there and kind of not getting any feedback, not knowing what people are thinking of it. And, you know, we don't live in a vacuum. And an essential part of art is sharing it with other people. Sometimes in art, there's this complete disconnect where there's art on the walls. Someone may come in, they may like it, may not, but they don't feel drawn to it in a personal or emotional way. By putting it in Second Life, it brings it directly to them. It becomes part of their world. The conventional art world is always a few steps behind. I mean, you can trace that back to the 19th century. The Impressionists were considered low class, and at this point, computer and gaming art is considered the low class. Most people, when I tell them about Second Life, if they know about it at all, they had absolutely no idea about the creative component. By describing it to them, especially with visuals, they have this completely new conception of what it is. Whether I pull up a still image or a machinima, or even if I go in world and show them one of my builds, I think a lot of them are actually blown away. They had no idea that you could do such things in here. I mean, most people, if they see a video game environment, automatically assume it's made by someone else. It's made by a company. And that everyone who goes in there is just kind of goofing off, you know, wandering around, you know, playing games. I mean, I went to college. I had no idea what I was going to do, like a lot of 18-year-olds. Just for fun, I'd be drawing in my dorm, and some of my dorm mates would look over my shoulder and say, "Hey, that's really good." At that point, I didn't really think of it as something that I would do. You know, I would always think that you do something else, and then you do art on the side. Later on, I took this class called Collage and Mixed Media. I often tie Second Life to that particular class because I was surrounded by all these other artists. To be able to get the feedback from everyone else was incredibly helpful. It's not a competition. This isn't a race. When you see a sporting event in the Olympics, someone comes in second, that's considered defeat. And, you know, that's nuts. And it's gone from bad to worse in our society because, for the very reason that art is harder to measure, our good politicians have decided to practically cut it out of the curriculums of many schools. As long as there's ability for these worlds, even if they're not embraced by everyone, at least there's somewhere where, you know, creative sorts can come. This gathering that's always there, almost specifically as a meeting of minds and creativity, there's no stopping it.
The Drax Files Radio Hour with Joe Yardley is a weekly production of Basic Drax Entertainment. The show is supported by Mira Cranfill, Beth Ghostraven, Inara Pays Modem World Blog, Madame Thespian Underhill's Fine Instruments and Furnishings, Kenny Lex Luckless, Natasha Rant, Schmooze Snook, Terry Allen, Pauline Clary, and Strawberry Singh. Special thanks to Torley for providing the station ID this week. Contact the show via Skype, DraxFiles, Avatar DraxFiles, or email radio@draxfiles.com.